It's a great pleasure now to introduce Mark Newman. So Mark was actually an undergraduate here and a postgraduate student in theoretical physics a scarily long time ago. It seems like yesterday, but he did his DPhil in 1991, he tells me. So he's had a very distinguished... Very... Well, it is for me. I know it just gets worse. So he's had a very distinguished career in basically the theory of complex systems, and he started out here working with David Sherrington, who also many of you will know, and he's currently on sabbatical leave here from the University of Michigan, where he's Rappaport Distinguished Professor, and he's going to talk to us today about structure in complex systems.
I'm going to talk about complex systems and what computer simulation can tell us about them today. So first of all, what even is that? Complex systems sounds like you could describe almost anything, really. But in physics, this means a very specific thing. A complex system is a system that is composed of many similar interacting parts. So in the most famous and traditional case, those would be atoms or molecules in a solid or a fluid. But one of the things that I want to emphasize today is that the ideas that we developed by studying atoms and molecules have since been applied to many other systems of interacting parts, and this has allowed us to apply physics-type methods to a huge range of things, as John described in his opening remarks this morning, including many things that are well outside what we consider to be the traditional purview of theoretical physics. Things like cells in a biological organism, animals in an ecosystem, people in a human community, cars driving down the road, computers on the internet, all sorts of things. And I'll give you some examples of these things as we go along. However, a complex system is not just a system of interacting parts. The other crucial feature of it is what we call emergence, which is that it shows behaviors, collective behaviors, as a result of the interactions of all of these parts. If I wanted to be cliched about it, I could say that the whole is more than just the sum of the parts. This was very nicely described in a paper by the physicist and Nobel laureate Phil Anderson in the 1970s called More is Different, a very famous paper in the field, one of the foundation papers in the field, published in the journal Science in 1972. And if you're interested in this, it's a very nice read. It's an easy read and contains lots of nice ideas. So a classic example of an emergent behavior in a physical system would be, for instance, the ideal gas law, PV equals RT, which relates the pressure, the volume, and the temperature of a gas. A gas, of course, is made up of lots of interacting parts, many atoms or molecules, and they're all moving about, bumping into each other, and interacting, repelling, attracting in complicated ways. And yet, out of all of that, emerges at some higher level this beautiful, simple law, just one equation that relates these three variables. In fact, there are many cases historically where we knew about the emergent law, like the ideal gas law, for instance, before we actually knew what the microscopic physics was. In this case, we didn't even know about the existence of atoms or molecules when they first discovered that PV equals RT. In many ways, the whole of physics is only really possible because of this concept of emergence. You can look at the physical universe as layers upon layers of emergence of laws at higher and higher scales as you start at the beginning at the bottom and work up. At the bottom, you might have quarks and gluons, and they combine to form protons, baryons, which then combine to form nuclei. The nuclei pick up electrons, they make atoms. The atoms combine into chemistry and eventually into solid objects. And solid objects have their own emergent laws at larger scales, some of which we'll talk about. If this didn't happen, if we were obliged to describe all of physics in terms of the very lowest level, in terms of quarks and gluons, then it would be absolutely hopeless. You can't describe a bulldozer in terms of quarks and gluons. So the fact that we can do physics at all, in some sense, is reliant on this concept of emergence. Let me give you some examples of specific complex systems. I mentioned condensed matter systems, a good example, the interaction of many atoms or molecules to produce, for instance, a solid, a good example of an emergent property of a solid is solidity itself, right? You can't really meaningfully talk about whether a single atom is solid or liquid or anything else. Solidity, you know, the property of this table here is something that only happens when you put many of them together. Solidity, physically, solidity is a result of the Pauli exclusion principle, the principle that says that for certain kinds of particles, you can't have two of them in the same place at the same time. The fundamental reason why I don't fall down through the floor of this room into the room below is because my particles can't be in the same place as the particles of the floor. Most of me is made up of space. I'm made up of particles, of course, but most of it is just space between the particles. In principle, you'd think, well, I could just fall through the floor, but I can't because of the exclusion principle. Once you have solidity, then you can have other emergent phenomena like electrical conduction, like sound waves, like superconductivity, all sorts of things. We don't tend to normally describe condensed matter systems as being complex systems, quote unquote, but that's really just historical. Condensed matter physics goes back way farther than what we now call the study of complex systems, and it's its own very large and thriving branch of physics, so it's really its own thing. We just call it condensed matter physics. However, morally speaking, it absolutely is an example of what I'm talking about, this phenomenon of emergence, when you get the interactions of many particles together, and it's by looking largely at condensed matter systems that we have learned the tricks that allow us to now apply the same kinds of techniques to the study of other complex systems in other areas. Another example might be a fluid. So sometimes atoms and molecules combine to make a liquid, not a solid. And an example of an emergent phenomenon there is just fluid flow, macroscopic fluid flow, as described by the Navier-Stokes equations. Navier-Stokes equations are really just one equation, a beautiful equation that describes fluid flow at a macroscopic scale. Of course, it's a result of the motions of many individual atoms or molecules at a smaller scale, but what we see on the large scale is this beautiful equation which describes an emergent phenomenon, macroscopic fluid flow. An ecosystem is a system of many interacting organisms, and an example of an emergent behavior there would be evolution.
Evolution is the survival of the fittest. Well, you can't be the fittest unless there's somebody fitter than. So it's fundamentally a result of competition between organisms. All the things we think of as being the fundamental elements that give rise to evolution, like mutation, genetic drift, selection, and so forth, are the result of competition between different organisms. If you only had one organism, you wouldn't have that kind of competition. To give a human example, a market, like a stock market, for instance, is a good example of a complex system of interacting components, many traders trading with one another, buying and selling. So an emergent behavior there, for instance, is price setting. How do I decide what the price is? I've got an apple. What is the value of this apple? What is the price of this apple? I don't know unless I have somebody to buy and sell from. Prices only mean something once you buy and sell for people. If I want to know which is more valuable, this apple or this orange, I can only tell in the context of the market. If I'm just one person on my own and nobody's trading with, then there's no concept of prices. Another human example, road traffic. Cars on the highway are the interacting agents here. They're interacting with one another, and an example of an emergent behavior there would be a traffic jam. Right? You can't have a traffic jam with one car. Right? You've got to have more than one car. So it's a traffic jam is fundamentally a result of interactions between the components of that system. So how do we go about simulating these things on a computer? Well, what you do is you make some computer model. You make a model on your computer of these things, kind of similar to the climate models that Professor Allen was talking about in the previous talk. I'm going to talk about a few of those models, but before I do, I want to make what I think is an important point about the level of complexity of the models that we use. So we use models of a range of levels of complexity. It's possible, in principle, to build models that, on the high end over here on the right, are very complex and try to incorporate essentially all of the complexity that's there in the real system. There's good reasons for trying to build models like that. What they allow you to do is make detailed quantitative predictions about the way a system will behave. However, many of the models we build are not like that. Many of them are simplified, often extremely simplified. So over here at the other end of the scale, on the left here, we build simple models which throw out many aspects of the real system that we're trying to mimic. And in the process, that often means that they're not quantitatively accurate. They're not going to tell you the exact number
an exact numerical prediction about the way a system behaves, but nonetheless they can be extremely useful because they're so simple, we can understand what they're doing. We can look at how a model behaves on the computer, and when it does something funny, it's simple enough that we can understand why it does that, and hence we can learn things about the way these systems behave. So we build both of these kinds of models, so simple ones that teach us how things happen and complex ones that make quantitative numerical predictions about things. Unfortunately, in most of the areas we're working in, there's no overlap between these two things. You can't have both things at once. You can have either numerical prediction, predictive accuracy, or you can have something that's simple and easy to interpret, but you can't have both at once. There is one area where you can, and that's in, you know, traditional physics, right? In physics, we do have very simple models that simultaneously give beautiful predictive accuracy, like Newton's laws, you know, F equals ma, or like the Schrodinger equation. It's one equation, the Schrodinger equation, and yet it predicts non-relativistic quantum phenomena with terrific accuracy. This phenomenon was famously, by Eugene Wigner, the physicist, called this the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. I think it's still a bit of a mystery why mathematics works so well in physics. Simple mathematics gives us beautiful, accurate predictions. Unfortunately, it's absolutely not true in essentially any other area. If you're in biology or biophysics, or you're trying to predict the stock market or something like that, you have to choose. You have to choose between simple models, which you can understand, but don't give you predictive accuracy, and complex models, which may be able to predict things, but you probably can't understand what they're doing because they're almost as complex as the real-world system that you're trying to model. So let me give you an example. I'll go back to that example of traffic on a motorway a moment ago. Here is perhaps the simplest model of traffic on a road. This is called the Nagel-Schreckenberg model. It was invented by Kai Nagel and Michael Schreckenberg. And so this is traffic on a road. So this strip represents the road. It's divided into boxes, and each box can have a car in it or not have a car in it. So these two red boxes have cars in, and all the other ones don't have cars. And then the model works like this. Every car just looks at the space ahead of it down the road, and if that space is empty, it moves into it. And then you just keep on doing that. You keep on moving down the road. Okay. So this is what we call a cellular automaton model, I guess because it's divided into cells. And it's obviously wildly unrealistic, right? There's no question about that. You know, cars don't sit in squares. They don't just jump along the road like this. It's obviously wrong. And yet, it manages to capture some crucial things about the way real cars behave on the road. So here's a little simulation that I did of the Nagel-Schreckenberg model. It's not a very sophisticated graphics here. This is not Xbox quality, but it gets the principle across. So I have this car moving along the road, and I have periodic boundary conditions. So if it goes off one end of the road, it just comes back on the other one end, and it'll happily just keep on going round and round like that. So there's one car on my road. Okay, fine, so it just drives along. That's realistic. That's what a car would do if the road was empty. I can put several cars on the road at the same time and have them all drive along. In this particular model, they all drive at the same speed, which is probably a little unrealistic. On real roads, cars drive at different speeds, but in this model, they all drive at the same speed. But now, look what happens if I put a very large number of cars on the road. An interesting thing happens. It looks like they're going backwards. What's up with that? So they're not actually going backwards. Cars are still going forwards. What's going backwards is the traffic jams on the roads. So in order to shed a little more light on this, here I did a slightly more sophisticated simulation. This is not changing. Come on, go. Okay, here's my that's the wrong one. Go back to this one. Here's my slightly more sophisticated simulation. So here's my road. I have a bunch of cars on the road, and they start moving like this. And now, if you look, there's a traffic jam here. Here it is. It's here at the moment. And you can see it's moving backwards along the road because cars are coming up behind it, and they get stuck in the traffic jam, and then they're leaving again from the front of the traffic jam. And the net result is it just moves backwards down the road. And it'll sit here and go on doing that for as long as you like. So this is a really simple model, but this is a real phenomenon. This actually happens in real traffic. This is observed, so the sort of thing that will happen on the motorway is there'll be an accident or something like that, and so there's a tailback, cars pile up, And then sometime later, they'll clear the accident out of the way and the traffic will start to move again. But the traffic jam goes on having a life of its own, propagating backwards down the motorway for miles, sometimes hundreds of miles, and you'll come back hours later and there'll be a traffic jam 100 miles down the road with no visible cause for it at all, just sort of happily living its own life, moving backwards down. And this is exactly the explanation of it. Even though this is a very simple model, this is exactly what's going on. So this is a very simple simulation tool. Of course, you can make things more complicated. Here's a more complicated simulation where I have a grid of streets and I have traffic lights and I have cars going one way and I have cars going the other way. Incidentally, these simulations here, the ones with the fancier graphics, were done using a program called NetLogo, which is it's an educational simulation environment. It was designed to teach students how to do computer simulations. And it's really a lot of fun to play with. It's free. You can download it from the internet, install it on your own computer. And if you like this kind of stuff, I highly recommend it. It comes with a lot of simulations already built in, including this one here. So you just sort of load them up and you can play around with the sliders. You press go, press stop and see what it does. It's a lot of fun to play with. So NetLogo, I highly recommend it. So even this, of course, is not a very realistic simulation, but you can go a lot further. So we can go to the other end of that sliding scale to very realistic simulations of traffic. You can buy big commercial software packages which are designed to do detailed realistic simulations of real cars on real roads. You can program them with your exact roads as you have them. And it's become a standard part of the urban design processes. Before you build any new traffic flow, you will simulate it in a package like this. You don't just go out and build roads. You make sure that they're going to work before you spend millions of pounds building them. So these are top two are both packages for simulating road traffic. The bottom two are for simulating pedestrian traffic. People also do this for the flow of pedestrians. For instance, if you're building a public building like this one or a concert hall or something like that, they'll simulate pedestrian flows in that space before they build the building. They want to know, for instance, if there's an emergency and everybody has to leave the building, will they be able to get out quickly? Right. So there's absolutely a standard procedure now before you spend millions of pounds building some big new building. So I want to spend a bit of time talking about the ways in which we do these simulations. There are actually several different ways in which we do these simulations. But one I wanted to particularly talk about today is so-called Monte Carlo simulation. Monte Carlo simulation is it's originally a technique that's used for simulating random processes on a computer. That's why it's called Monte Carlo simulation. It's named after the Monte Carlo Quarter in Monaco, the home of the famous Monte Carlo Casino. So originally, the sort of things that we might have applied Monte Carlo simulation to are questions like this. If I'm rolling a die, so fundamentally random process, I'm rolling a die, how many times am I going to have to roll a die before I get a one? Okay, well, actually, I don't need to do a computer simulation for that. The answer's obvious, right? There's six sides to the die. Obviously, it's going to take six times on average before I get a one. But here's a more complicated question. How many times will I have to roll a die before I get every number at least once? Okay, well, that's a harder question. I'm not sure of the answer to that question. So I could answer it using a Monte Carlo simulation. So I did that. Here it is. Here's my Monte Carlo simulation. So I wrote this little program. It's written in the language Python. It's just 8 lines long. And basically all it does is, in simulation, it repeatedly rolls a die. So every computer these days has a random number generator built into it that can generate random numbers. For instance, I can ask it to generate random numbers between 1 and 6 to represent repeated rolls of the die, and then I just see how many times do I have to roll the die before I get all the numbers from 1 to 6. So here's me running my program. First time I wrote it, it printed out 14. It said I needed 14 rolls to get all of the numbers at least once. Second time it was 18, because it's random, right? It doesn't print out the same thing every time. It's a random process, so I run it again, I get a different number, and then 11 and 16 and 13 and 19 and 8 and 8 and so forth. Or here's me running it a million times and making a histogram of the results. So this shows me that on average, it's sort of about 13 times or something I need to roll the die in order to get all the numbers once. But sometimes I have to roll it 50 times because I'm very unlucky and I keep having to roll it before I get everything at least once. Okay, but now here's the thing. This question, of course, has an exact answer. Right, I didn't really need to do this simulation. It's a simple enough question that I could have answered this just by doing a little bit of arithmetic. It turns out that the expected number of times you're going to have to roll the die in order to get all the numbers from 1 to 6 is sum k equals 1 to 6 of 6 upon k, which is 147 upon 10, or 14.7 exactly. That's the mean number of rolls I'll have to do in order to get all of the numbers at least once. So we have this problem, which is it's fundamentally a random problem, and I can simulate it on a computer by doing a random simulation, but it also has an exact answer. Very early in the history of computing, in the 1940s, Stan Ulam and Nick Metropoulos and others at Los Alamos realized that you could use this trick in reverse. If random processes have exact answers, you can also take processes that have exact answers, and you can find a corresponding random thing that, if you simulate it, will give the same answer. So this means you can actually use the Monte Carlo simulation method not just to study random processes, but study a huge range of things within physics, even things that are not intrinsically random. This has hugely expanded the range of applications for Monte Carlo simulation. For instance, they're now widely used in the finance industry to make trading decisions for portfolios. Essentially, you're doing large-scale integrals over many dimensions using a Monte Carlo method. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Here's a very simple calculation. Suppose I wanted to calculate the number pi. Okay, so that number has an exact answer. It may look like a random string of digits to you, but it definitely has an exact answer. I could calculate it using a random process, however, as follows. I'm going to draw this circle. Here's, I've drawn a circle here, and I've drawn a square around it, and the square is 2 units by 2 units on each side. So that means that the diameter of the circle is also 2 units, which means its radius is 1 unit, which means its area, pi r squared, is just equal to pi, because r is equal to 1. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw a bunch of darts at the square. I mean, I'm not actually going to throw a bunch of darts. In simulation, I'm going to throw a bunch of darts just randomly at the square, and some of them will land inside the circle, and some of them will land outside the circle. What fraction of them will land inside the circle? Well, that's just equal to the area of the circle divided by the area of the square. So the fraction f that lands inside the circle is area of the circle divided by the area of the square. We've said the area of the circle is pi, and the area of the square is 2 by 2, so that's just 4, so I've got pi upon 4. Or put that another way, if I can measure the fraction of hits I get inside the circle and multiply it by 4, I'll get the number pi. So that's what I did. Here's my program. Again, a very trivial program. I'm not going to get a job at Microsoft at this rate. Just 8 lines, but it does exactly what I said. So it generates random x and y coordinates to represent the darts, and it works out if they're inside the circle, and if they are, it counts a hit. And at the end, it just prints out the fraction of hits multiplied by 4. So you run it. First time it runs, it says 3.140. Second time it runs, it says 3.141. Not exactly the same number, because it's a random process. But it's a pretty good approximation to pi. 3.14, 3.14, 3.14, 3.13, 3.14. Okay, so it's done pretty well. It's got the value of pi to 3 decimal places, with parts in 1,000, by doing a random process, even though this is a question that has an exact answer. Apparently, doing this experiment, well, roughly speaking, this experiment, was a popular pastime amongst amateur mathematicians in the 19th century. There's something called Buffon's needle, which is sort of essentially this experiment. You didn't do it with a computer because they didn't have them, but it just involves dropping a needle on a piece of paper and seeing how many hits you get. Apparently, this was a popular thing to do. It was most famously done by this guy Mario Lazzarini in 1901, who dropped a needle more than 3,000 times and was able to calculate the value of pi to 6 decimal places, which would be a very impressive feat if it weren't for the fact that he almost certainly faked his results. Statisticians have looked at this experiment. Dropping a needle 3,000 times and getting 6 decimal digits of accuracy is highly statistically improbable. So they've looked at this experiment and they said, basically, there's no way this could ever happen. He just made up his results. It wasn't real. So it's kind of sad. Okay, so let me give you some examples of applications of Monte Carlo simulation to various complex systems. Here is a famous, well-known example. So this is something called diffusion-limited aggregation. So the process here is that you have a clump of particles or atoms or something here in the middle of the picture, and you have one particle coming on top here. And what it does is it just diffuses around. So it wanders around at random until it hits the clump. And wherever it hits, it sticks. It just stays wherever it hits. And then another particle comes on, and it diffuses around until it sticks. And the question is, what happens if you just keep on doing this? So you might think what would happen is you'd just get a round sort of blob that would grow bigger and bigger in the middle of the picture. But it turns out that's not what happens. So here's my program to do that. It's a little bit more complicated than the other programs, but it's not that much. And here's what happens when you run it. So you start with a particle in the middle there, and you start adding these particles. And what you see is this beautiful sort of filamentary growing thing in the middle of the picture. It's not a round blob by any means. It's some very complicated thing with these sort of dendritic growths coming outside. So what's happening here is that if you have these sort of fjords, and in principle, you could get a particle going all the way down one of these fjords and sticking in the middle here somewhere, but it's very unlikely to do that because the particle is sort of wobbling around at random, and probably it's just going to stick to one of the walls of the fjord before it ever gets down into the middle. So in other words, the further in you go, the less likely you are to stick. You're most likely for the particles to just stick on the outer edges, and that's why it's growing in this sort of filamentary way rather than sort of just some round blob. You're most likely to stick to the tips of these filaments and grow there. So simple though it is, this process mimics things that we see in real life. So these pictures, they look like corals or something growing in the sea, but they're not. They're actually computer simulations done using a variant of the process I just described by this guy, Jaap Kandor. It's believed that real corals in the sea grow by something roughly akin to this process. There's nutrients drifting around in the sea, and they sort of aggregate onto the outsides of the corals, but they're more likely to aggregate onto the tips than they are to go into the middle. And so you can get shapes that look kind of like this diffusion-limited aggregation. There are some parameters in the model here that you can twiddle, and you can vary the overall shape from some dense things like this to very sparse things like that, which also mimic the range of structures that one sees in real corals growing in the sea. Here's another example. This example is something that I've worked on. It's called percolation. So percolation, again, starts off as a very simple process. Percolation starts off with a lattice of nodes or sites like this, and I throw down connections between them one by one, purely at random, just like this. I just keep on doing that, and eventually, you know, have something that looks like that. So this system shows some interesting behaviors. Depending on how many of these bonds I throw down on the lattice. If I throw down only a few, then I get something like this, where I have a few clusters of connected nodes, but mostly it's unconnected. On the other hand, if I throw down a lot, then I have something more like this, where pretty much everything is all connected up together. And crucially, it's quite easy to find a path that takes you all the way across the system from one side to the other. And in between those two extremes, there's a special point in the middle called the percolation point, at which you go from having things all sort of broken up into separate clumps to being all connected together. So the first point at which a path all the way across the lattice forms, that's the percolation point. And the interesting thing is that point always happens at the same moment, right? There's a crucial, a magic number of connections that you throw down at which this percolation point happens. Doesn't matter how many times you do it. Over and over again, it happens at the same point. It's what we call a phase transition. So there is this sudden change from a regime in which it's sort of all split up into separate parts to a regime in which it's connected together and you can get all the way across the system from one side to the other. So why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting for a number of different reasons. It's actually used for as a model of a lot of different things. But in my own work, we've used it as a model for the spread of disease. So imagine that the dots on the lattice represent people. And if you're a person, so this person here has the flu, for instance, this red dot. And they could, in principle, give the flu to any of their neighbors, their friends, the people up, down, left, and right of them on the lattice. But even if you have the flu, you don't necessarily give it to your friends, right? You might not happen to see this friend this week, or if you do see them, you might not happen to cough on them, right? So there's some probability, we'll call it P, is the probability that you do spread your flu to this friend. So we're going to represent that by filling in some fraction of the bonds on the lattice with probability P, and the other ones are not filled in. So the ones that are filled in represent pairs of people that had contact sufficient to spread the disease. Then the disease starts with this initial carrier here, and it's clear what's going to happen. It can only spread along the black lines, and so eventually it just affects all of the people in the connected cluster that it starts in, but not the rest of lattice. So now you can see why it's crucial whether you're in this regime where everything's disconnected or where you're in the regime where everything is connected together. If you're in the regime where everything is connected together, then the disease is going to spread. So you get a behavior that looks like this. This is just a sketch. Horizontal axis is this transmission probability P. Vertical axis is the size of the outbreak. If the probability is low, you get nothing, 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 just tiny outbreaks of the disease. And then you go through the percolation threshold, And suddenly you get the disease spreading to a significant fraction of everybody in the system. We get what we call an epidemic outbreak of the disease. This is called the percolation threshold in physics. It's called the epidemic threshold in epidemiology. And both camps have known about this for decades. It's absolutely the same thing. It really is the same thing, the same physical phenomenon. All public health interventions that are aimed at controlling the spread of infectious disease are aimed at reducing this transmission probability so that you push yourself below this epidemic threshold. You do not need to prevent transmission altogether. You don't need to get it down to zero. You only need to get it below this level, and then the disease will die out. So if that were not true, it would be much harder to control diseases than it is. Well, there's a catch here. The catch is, of course, real people don't live on a square grid, right? Real people live in some complicated world where there's some complicated network of connections between them, who's friends with whom, who has contact with whom, and some of those connections are sufficient to transmit the disease. Those are the bold ones in this picture, and some of them, the gray ones, you didn't happen to see that friend this week, and so they're not. There's no transmission there. So now the disease starts with some person, it's going to spread to the people it can reach along the bold edges. So one of the things we do is we look at the real structure of these networks, these contact networks in the real world. This, for instance, is a picture that comes from my friend Valdis Krebs from a study he did on the spread of tuberculosis. But we now have data on a lot of these networks of connections. They can become extremely complex. And one of the questions we look at is, how does the structure of this complex network affect the way the disease spreads? Or if we could change the structure to reduce the spread of disease, what would we do? Or if we're going to vaccinate some people in this community, who are the best people to vaccinate to reduce the spread of the disease? So we can tackle all sorts of questions like this by understanding the interplay between the structure of the network and the percolation process taking place on it. You can take this further still, we can go towards the other end of that sliding scale of complexity to really detailed models. Here's an example of that. This is a simulation put together by Steve Eubank and his collaborators called EpiSims. And what this is it's a detailed micro simulation of the spread of disease. They built a computer model of an entire city. It's a real city. It's the city of Portland, Oregon, on the west coast of the United States. The simulation has every house, every building, every street, every car, it has every person in it. When the simulation runs, people get up in the morning in their houses and they get into their cars and they drive to work and they get out of their car and they go into the building and they catch the flu from their person that they work with and then they drive home in the evening and they give it to their kids and so forth. So it's really a detailed simulation of all of the processes going on in this city, and then once you have this, then you can try out different strategies. You know, if I want to prevent spread of disease, let's try out a particular public health intervention and see what it does in the simulation. A very useful thing to be able to do when you're talking about the spread of disease, because this is one area where, for sure, we cannot do the experiment, right? You can't just release a disease into the population and see what happens, right? It's absolutely crucial to be able to predict in advance, before it happens, what is going to happen. Here's another example. This is from work by Vittoria Kalitsa and collaborators. They were interested in the worldwide spread of disease. And if that's what you're interested in, then the primary vector you need to know about is aeroplanes. Aeroplanes are the main way that diseases travel across the planet. Aeroplanes are basically just little metal tubes full of germs hurtling through the air. This is how diseases spread around the world. They spread around the world by people getting on airplanes and taking their diseases with them. So they built a simulation that has every flight of every passenger airline in the world built into it, and how many people on average go on that flight and so forth. And so they can build a detailed simulation. In this particular case, they imagined an epidemic that starts in Hanoi, Vietnam, and then they could predict when it's going to arrive in all of these various cities in Europe and how many people are going to get sick when it gets there, so forth. All of these diseases I've been talking about are diseases that fall in one particular category, so-called SIR diseases. Those are diseases where everybody is either susceptible, infected, or recovered. And once you're recovered, you have immunity and you stay recovered forever. But there are other kinds of diseases as well. For instance, SIRS diseases are ones where recovered people can lose immunity, move back into the susceptible pool, and get the disease again. And there are more complicated flow diagrams still for more complicated diseases. SIRS diseases are sort of interesting because you get a wave-like behavior in the disease, that you get a bunch of people who have the disease, and then people out here, the black is people who are susceptible, so the disease can spread into that black region, and the wave sort of moves forward, leaving a band of recovered people who have temporary immunity behind it. So you get these spreading waves that move across the system. This is an example of what's called a reaction diffusion system, another thing that we know a lot about in physics. Here, to finish with, is a quick simulation that I did, again using NetLogo, of a classic reaction diffusion system. And if you watch it for a while, what you see is sort of the classic behavior of these systems is the appearance of these waves spreading across the system, and particularly these sort of spiral formations, sometimes called scroll waves. Quite fun just to sit and watch this from. Okay, very good. So I'm just about out of time. So what we talked about here is how these complex systems can show simple emergent behaviors at higher levels, and we can understand some of those behaviors, like these waves in the system here, by doing simulations, often very simplified simulations of these systems, and yet they can shed a lot of light, give us a lot of understanding. At the other end of the scale, you can also build very elaborate models which give us the ability to predict in detail how things are going to behave, like how diseases are going to spread through systems. I'm out of time, so I should stop talking now, but thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.